So we will have the last two talks of today. And the first talk will be given by Sandra Spielvogel from the University of Bern. I guess now the University of Kiel.
Yes.
So welcome.
Exactly, now the University of Kiel. So first of all, I want to thank the conveners of this session for inviting me. I was really excited and also honored. So thank you for inviting me and to give me the possibility to present part of the results of my group here. And not only part of the results of my group, as you can see from the huge list of co-authors, this is really the results of a lot of people who contributed and also inspired me during my scientific career. So I do not want to go into much detail in this figure, but this is a bit a snapshot of our current knowledge about soil organic matter and element cycles in soil. And as this session focuses on, we have different techniques to get deeper into this knowledge. We have the isotopic approaches, which mainly enable us to quantify process rates. And we have also the spectroscopic techniques and the omics techniques, which I would summarize as techniques that enable us to characterize soil organic matter. And we normally call this simply biomarker approaches or biomarker techniques. And of course, we can combine both of them with each other. And while thinking about what I should present today, I thought probably I should even give something like a history through those techniques and start with the single isotope approaches and an example for a single biomarker approach and then come up with something that combines each other, those two techniques with each other, and then going into more advanced techniques. And so I will start with an example of an isotope approach that is usable to quantify carbon fluxes in soil. And this is a study of a PhD student, which I was supervising during several years. And the idea behind this is based on a publication of Gartner et al. We have this declining carbon contents with soil depth in the topsoil organic matter. And we have the increase in delta 13C value, and if we do a regression equation between the log carbon contents and the delta 13C, we can obtain this regression equations with the beta value, and Garden et al. Came up with the idea that we can use those beta values as an approximation of decomposition rates of topsoil organic matter. And our idea was now, or our question was now, whether we could find changes of those beta values with temperature, precipitation, and time. And for this, we did a meta-analysis with 22 studies worldwide, really distributed over the whole globe, and calculated those beta values for those studies. And this is the equation that we found, and we can see that there is really quite a nice relationship between these beta values, which increase with increasing mean annual temperature, which pretty much shows that this approach really can be used to relate topsoil organic matter decomposition rates with mean annual temperature. And this gets even better, this relationship, if we divide the sample set again, if we divide it according to mean annual precipitation. So the value we divided, we used for the grouping of the sample set is 1,500 millimeter mean annual precipitation. So this is a small but, to my opinion, nice example for an isotope approach. But this session does not only refer to isotopic approaches, but also to biomarker approaches. And if I get an invitation from Antra, I know I must bring something about suberin and cutein, because this is what she expects from me. And since I'm one of the two last speakers of this session, I have a big advantage, and this advantage is that I do not need to explain too much anymore, because anything has been explained before, and also what suberin is. So suberin is a root biomarker, and this is taken from a publication in 2014, and we used here those suberin biomarker stocks to relate it to different root systems of trees, and we could nicely show that the different root systems trigger the distribution of the suberin stocks in the soil, as it is shown here for European beech, but we found the same for Douglas fir, for Norway spruce, and so on. So really, these different rooting systems, they create patches of different organic matter composition in the soil, and this significantly affects soil organic carbon stock origin and composition in the immediate vicinity of those trees. But it does not only trigger the distribution of the organic carbon in the vicinity of the trees, it also relates back to what happens in the soil. So, because after I did this study during my postdoc position in Freising, I came back to the sites and did some additional analysis, and we can clearly see that with increasing distance from the tree, so these are the same distance increments that we see here, we also have a difference in enzyme activity, as an example here, the beta-glucosidase activity, and we also have a decrease of fungal to bacterial phospholipid fatty acid ratio. So really the tree itself creates patches where it impacts what is happening in the soil, how the organic matter is stabilized, how it is aggregated, mineral associated, and how the microbial community is composed and functioning in the different distance increments from the tree. So this is a nice little example for a pure biomarker approach, but this session has the title Isotope and Biomarker Approaches, and therefore I now want to come to some more modern, advanced approaches that combine isotope approaches with spectroscopic and biomarker techniques. And for my first example of this combined approach, I want to leave the area of carbon and come up with some results on phosphorus, because I'm dealing not only with carbon but also with nutrient cycling, as I showed it in the title of this presentation. And one new approach that was developed in our labs, if I say our labs, I always combine Bern with Kiel and Göttingen, so Jakob is also here. And this method is linking the classical PLFA analysis to 33 phosphorus incorporation into microorganisms. So we had already several presentations, for example, from Jakob this morning, who explained the phospholipid acids. And what we did is that we combined the changes in fatty acid methyl ester composition in some experiments with the measurement of 30C labeled phosphorus in the head group of this phospholipid acids. And for this, we did an isotrone experiment because we were interested in the question whether phosphorus heterogeneity shapes microbial activity in the soil. And therefore, we planted different rhizo boxes, which were labeled with three different spatial patterns of 33 iron phosphate in soil. So we had in all of those rhizo boxes the same total amount of 33 phosphorus, but in this rhizo box, a box that was homogeneously distributed, here it was very small, patchy, heterogeneously distributed, and here it was a bit of coarser heterogeneity distribution. And we did this not only with one total phosphorus concentration, but with a high and a low phosphorus concentration, and we were interested in measuring the 33 phosphorus uptake into microbial biomass and into the and whether the overall pattern of the phospholipid fatty acid changed. And this is the outcome of the result of this study. And first of all, you can clearly see that we have a clear increase in the uptake of 33 phosphorus into the microbial phospholipid acids with increasing patchiness. And we also have a change. This is shown with the lines on top. We have a change, especially at the high phosphorus concentrations, in the relative proportion of fungi PLFA to total PLFA. So when I made this figure together with Thomas Ziller, who is the PhD student responsible for this study, we only had the PLFA results, but meanwhile we even have DNA results, and they clearly show that this PLFA fungi PLFA, which we measured here, is an ectomycorrhiza PLFA. So what we can say is that if we have high concentrations of phosphorus that form hotspots in the soil, this obviously triggers the fungi and especially the ectomycorrhiza to invest energy to grow into those phosphorus hotspots and release phosphorus even from such sources like iron phosphate, which is not a very easy available phosphorus source. So, yeah. This is what I already told you now. And with this example, how to combine isotopic techniques with biomarker techniques, I will come to a very novel combination technique that was already introduced by Jakob this morning, if you also attended the morning session of this session, and this is the position-specific labeling in combination with compound-specific isotope analysis. And what I want to present you as an example for this technique is somehow a following up experiment to the experiment that was presented by Jakob. He showed you, if you remember, this example where alanine, you see here this little molecule of alanine, was thought to get it and I think also smacked it, because it is thought that sorption is a major stabilization process, especially for small molecules like glucose, like alanine and so on in soil, because normally such a small molecule would be quite easy microbial available. But it is thought that sorption is a process that might stabilize especially such small molecules, and therefore we this time incubated uniformly and position specifically labeled alanine, but we solved it not to Goethe it, as it was shown by Jakob in the morning session, but we solved it to, I would say, real soil. This soil was first of all sterilized by gamma radiation, and then we had those differently labeled alanine compounds in different positions labeled. The soil, the sterilized soil, was put into the label and then it was shaken. Oh, I like this animation, I must say. And of course, the rest of the alanine that was not sorbed was removed, so we washed the soil to remove the rest of the alanine, and then we had for comparison a treatment with free alanine where tracer solutions were added to dry soil, and these tracer solutions had exactly the same amount of alanine that was also at the sorbed examples, and the tracers, the sorbed tracers, were also added to dry soil and revetted with pure water. And now I will show you the outcome of this sorption experiment. As we already know from Paul's, but also from Jakob's talk, is that the first position, this purple carbon position, is respired first, and therefore we cannot find much of this in the PLFAs. We find much more of the second and the third position and in the PLFA, but what is surprising is that there is not much difference between the sorbed and the free alanine. The overall pattern is pretty much resembling and fits very well to the overall basic metabolism of alanine of the microbes. But very interesting for us was the question, is there a preferential uptake? And for most of the microbial groups, we found the same pattern that is shown here as an example for the gram-positives, and you see that you can see nothing. There is not a difference between the free and the salt alanine. It's taken up both to the same extent, and so for most of the microbes we can say there is no preferential uptake. We had some specialists, as for example the actinobacteria, pretty well known to feed especially on necromass, and you can see in contrast to the gram-positives where the label decreases with time, we have an increase with time for the actinobacteria because they feed on the necromass, so this is already some kind of recycling, as it was also shown in the example with the geotide for from Jakob. But the most interesting result was probably for the fungi, because this was the only group where we really found a preferential uptake, but they preferentially took up the sorbed alanine. And so the question is why? And our explanation is that fungi grow over particles. And if you have particles where alanine or any other compound is sorbed, This is preferentially taken up especially by those specialists which grow over those particles. So this is better available for them. And we have also an interesting result. There must be something different in the metabolism because we have a preferential incorporation of the first and the second position and not of the third position as it would be by the pure basis metabolism. So I will end not with a conclusion, but with an outlook, because I did it like a history, and the history ends normal with an outlook. So where to go? I think one promising future direction would be to combine this group-specific metabolism tracing with other omics techniques, for example, the SIP technique that was introduced by Jennifer Petridge this morning, to get even a deeper insight into which microbial groups are related to this carbon and nutrient cycling, but also to combine it with the flux modeling that was introduced by Paul Chikstra. And this is actually something that is already going on in the cooperation between, for example, Michi and Paul. So you know this flux model from the talk of Paul. And if you combine this with our approaches, you can come up, you can trace the catabolic fluxes and the CO2 production, but you can also trace the anabolic, the biosynthetic fluxes, because you can follow those positions into the metabolic products, the biomarkers, and you can calculate the carbon use efficiency. This was already presented by Paul, and come up with something which we meanwhile call fluxomics, fluxes through different microbial groups. And as a last outlook, we could also come up and combine this technique with a method that enable us to localize processes on biogeochemical interfaces, like, for example, nanosynths. This is a result of Steffens et al., followed or who measured distinct functional microstructural aggregate domains on the surface of one single aggregate, and he found or could distinguish two different composed aggregate domains and some kind of an intermediate domain, which are completely different composed. And it would be quite interesting to use our technique to follow the fluxes of microbial groups in those different domains and to figure out what are the habitat functions of those different domains. And with this, I want to thank you for your attention and for this inspiring and nice session.